Support for Talking Art comes from Quad City Bank and Trust, providing consumer and commercial banking as well as trust and asset management. For more information, visit qcbt.bank or stop by one of QCBT's 5 locations.
This is Carolyn Martin, and I'm talking art today with Kevin Jones, the curator for the FIDA Museum at the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising in Los Angeles, about the exhibition Sporting Fashion, Outdoor Girls 1800 to 1960 at the Figge Art Museum. Hi there, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. And we're so happy you're able to join us today, because this show that's at the Figge now is so interesting. You know, you might for a moment when you walk in think that it's all about fashion, particularly sporting fashion, but very quickly you come to understand that that history and the quest for women's equality are the more serious issues that are explored here. As a curator, do you see fashion as a means of social commentary?
Oh, completely. The fact that all of us get dressed in the morning and go out to do our business out in society, really speaks to the individual, each one of us, as if we're going out at night to a club and we're dressing for ourselves, or if we're going out perhaps during the day for work and we're dressing to be part of a collective. You know, it's all about that presentation, and it doesn't matter if it's high fashion fancy or it's workwear. It's all social commentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see that the themes of individuality, but then when you walk through that century and a half of change, you really come to understand the resilience that was required of women, the resourcefulness. There's somewhat of a societal critique, and I love the fact too that this deals with women and their lives that outdoors, beyond the spheres that they were in essence confined to before.
Yes. Now, one of the things that Christina Johnson, she's the associate curator here at the FIDA Museum and my co-curator for the exhibition and the catalog, one of the things we wanted to really talk about was that, honestly, you know, women were not confined in the sense like they were never allowed outdoors because somebody was standing at the portal, you know, and saying, no, you can't go outside. You know, women had full active lives the way they do now, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Yes, it was different because we dressed differently. Transportation was different. Science was different. You know, there's all sorts of different things that we enjoy today that not necessarily people in the past enjoyed, particularly women. And there were different proprieties of how one conducted oneself, how dressing. 100, 150 years ago, men dressed very similarly to the way they do now. Women do not, for the most part. So things have changed. However, you know, honestly, if a man was out doing something fun, active, and a woman was interested in doing that as well, she was going to figure out a way. And often it was figuring out a way to do whatever that action was, that sport was much more creative even than the way men were doing it, because they had to figure out how they could do this. The equipment, the dress, was it only something amongst other women, or could it be, you know, a commingled sport? So women were out having fun and being active as much as men, because don't forget that, you know, for the most part with this exhibition, we are talking about people with leisure time. You know, you could have the full day for leisure, or maybe it was a Sunday afternoon of leisure. So there was leisure time invested into all of these sports. There were some people, men and women, who basically had no leisure time in their lives. They worked constantly. And so there is a difference here of those who had the ability to do these kinds of sporting activities. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, across the board, women were as active as men, just sometimes in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you spent 3 weeks here in the Quad Cities. That's a long time installing the show. It was an extensive and lengthy installation. And the entire third and fourth floors of the Figge are literally filled with an enormous number of ensembles and accessories. So how is the exhibition organized?
It's on the two floors, and the curators, Josh and Vanessa, they are the ones who actually kind of did the layout for the gallery, since they know their Figge Museum very well. I don't. This was the first time that I got to visit Davenport and the Figge Museum, so that was very exciting. And honestly, it took the 3 weeks because it is such a large show. Indeed, there are more than 480 individual objects that are traveling with the show, and splitting them on the two floors does lengthen the time, because we were running up and down the stairs or taking the art freight elevators, you know, constantly. So the layout, the show itself and the catalog is broken up into eight themes. So basically there are four themes per floor that you walk around and explore. And it's a really great way of digesting, you know, the show, because there is a lot to see and a lot to learn.
There really is. There's more than 40 activities, I read. And, you know, one thing that I found interesting is that early in the 19th century, when this begins, things that we would normally not think of as sports, but definitely are outdoors, the activities are included, such as promenading was one. I hadn't really thought of that. Gardening, picnicking. We don't consider these to be sports now, but they were ways to get outdoors.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that Christina and I wanted to do specifically, was to broaden that definition of sportswear, sporting fashion, sports. Because, you know, it's true, 200 years ago, there were activities that women were doing that were physically active out of their familial environment, out of their homes, that were considered sporty in their day. We wouldn't necessarily now. Simply going out for a walk, a promenade, you know, in a garden, graveyards were a really popular place to go have picnics, no kidding. And it's to do these kinds of activities that required an additional layer of clothing that would signal to anybody that you were going out to do something physical. And so that's how the development of what we now know of as sportswear happened. It did come out of the fashion world, you know, and nothing ever just drops out of the sky fully formed. There are fits and starts. You have different areas, different people at different times coming up with ideas for dress. I mean, all of these women were entrepreneurs in their day, figuring out what to wear that was appropriate, the materials that they could acquire to do whatever sport they wanted, whether they needed to have a lot of movement because of, and so they incorporated knitwear into their outfits, or they needed to be warm because it was a cold environment. So, you know, there was lots of things happening at different times that then coalesced slowly but surely as the decades progressed to what we now recognize as kind of active everyday sportswear, and also sport uniform that's very specific for games like, you know, basketball, tennis.
Well, in the process of your research, was there a particular activity or sport that captivated you or that piqued your interest or curiosity?
There was, because it really is the founding of what we think of as sportswear now. And it's the riding habit. That really is one of the earliest examples of specific dress, but worn by women to do something that everybody would know what she was doing when she walked out of her door.
And are you talking like equestrian riding?
Equestrian riding.
Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, equestrian, it could be very formal. It really started in the later part of the 16th century. Now, if you read my opening chapter, I do take this back to the classical era. There is very little before the 18th century about sportswear, women, and what they wore specifically that has been recorded. And, you know, history forgets what time forgets what history does not record. And it's that's why it's so important to, like, document everything. So moving forward, you know, you think 500 years from now, people are going to understand what we did and why we did what we did. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot of that from the classical era. So you think of sportswear and sports-specific clothing, it really is the late 16th century with equestrian riding wear, riding habits as they developed.
Mm-hmm. And it started, obviously, with women sitting side saddle and riding that way, correct? And it was only later, I think, that they were allowed to ride in divided clothing, what we would consider long pants or trousers.
Yes and no. It actually started out with women riding astride.
Mm.
And then as their clothing developed, women ended up with garments, skirts with a lot of fabric, which really wasn't very conducive to draping the legs over the horse. So it developed into the side saddle. So all that fabric could be to one side.
Mm-hmm.
Then it becomes kind of the norm for women to ride side saddle. And you never think of like, well, can a woman ride, you know, astride? Yes, she can. Does she? No. Why not? And then by the time you get to the turn of the 20th century, the idea of women riding astride becomes something more commonplace because it's not just the formal riding habits that women were wearing, but also you think of the women who were ranch women, who were out literally on the plains, and they were having to ride miles and miles and miles in the saddles. They needed something that was very hard wearing, that was very durable, that was not specifically fashionable show off the way it would have been with the more gentrified world. And so you do indeed have women riding side saddle. But I tell you, even at the highest level of society, and I'm talking the queens of countries, Catherine the Great of Russia, Queen Marie Antoinette of France, both of them were painted formal portraits that were exhibited publicly riding astride on horses. So again, this idea that we have that it was just this or just that when it comes to women and what they were wearing for any given reason, specifically sport, outdoor activities, we have to be really careful with kind of drawing that line in the sand, because I tell you, if a woman was seeing a man doing something and she thought it was great, she was going to figure out a way to do it, even if that included riding a horse astride and she was the Queen of France.
Well, I love that. You definitely get a sense when you go through this exhibition about the strength that it required. I was amazed at the mountaineering photographs. There are photos of women literally ascending falls in Yosemite and crossing crevasses, across a glacier in these long skirts with their waist ropes around them. And they were intrepid and they were fierce and they just did it.
They did. I'm telling you, there were women who were so much braver than any man ever would have been. Seriously, scaling the side of a mountain. We're not talking about going on a little passive hike up and over a little mound or something. We're literally talking scaling the side of a cliff where if you one little wrong step or one wrong grip and you fall and are seriously hurt or you die. These women were doing this, and they were doing them in skirts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know of a man, frankly, that would have dared to have done something like that in a skirt. And that's why there's a really sensational photo that of these two ladies. We know who they are. It was 1908. It was in Scotland. And they are literally scaling the side of a mountain, and they have their waist ropes on, you know, which is a kind of security. But if you really look at the photo, they're tied to each other at the waist. So if one falls,
the other
both
one,
normal, you know, and I mean, it's kind of amazing. And they are in skirts. Now in the exhibition, we are showing a woman in a divided skirt, which is a type of a bifurcated garment that the front panel buttons to one side to reveal kind of the divided skirt, or you could undo it and flip it over to the other side and rebutton. And then it's like, it looks like just a normal skirt. Hmm. It was true that, you know, if men were around in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century, women on the whole, you can never say never, but on the whole were required to wear skirts. If they were amongst all women, then a form of Turkish trousers, divided skirt, pantaloons were acceptable. And that's one of the things that's interesting about that photo of the two women mountaineering is that they were actually, it was an all-woman group. And yet they're still in skirts.
Hmm.
You know, these were personal choices. It was not a dictation. It was a personal choice within the proprieties at the time. But of course, we always know that every generation is pushing the proprieties that are established for their time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I read in the catalog that there was a fortuitous discovery that inspired you to curate this mm-hmm. show. Can you tell us about that? You found a garment and a vintage show.
Yeah. In fact, it wasn't even a garment. It was just a piece of cloth. it was at a vintage show, and I normally don't look at scarves. We have a really phenomenal scarf collection here. I mean, just really, really beautiful graphic designed pieces. And this scarf was literally across the room, and I looked at it, and I don't know what it was, and it drew me over to it. And it was just this really great design. It's got a lot of movement going on, lots of colors. And it turns out it's 13 women doing all of these different sports all around this scarf. And the scarf is it's large. It's at least 3x3 feet. And I thought, oh, that's really neat. And then there's all this kind of scribbling around it. And I was like, what is that? And it says outdoor girl, outdoor girl, outdoor girl, outdoor girl, all over it. And so I called Christina. This was a Sunday morning. And I said, oh, I found this really amazing scarf. This is really great. And she was kind of surprised because she knows I normally don't look at those things. And she said, well, how much is it? And I said, oh, it's $38. And she's like, buy it. I mean, if you think it's something good for the collection, you know, like $38, it's, you know, buy it. And literally the very moment she said buy it, the little cartoon light bulb went off over my head, and I said to her on the phone, you know what, we're gonna do an exhibition on women's sportswear. Now at that time we had no idea how big it was gonna be, how long it was gonna take, what it was gonna incorporate, if it was gonna be just, you know, a small show in maybe our history gallery, a larger show in all of our gallery space, a book, who knows, you know. It was just like, let's do something like this.
Well, there was such serendipity to that, wasn't it? Because that spark, that random find of yours in a vintage show went on to you subsequently amassing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And that was initially in 2009. In 2015, you established a partnership with the American Federation of the Arts. And what did that partnership allow you to do?
I cannot praise the American Federation of Arts too highly. I mean, they are just marvelous. You know, this is an organization that has been in existence since 1909. They're a nonprofit headquartered out of New York City, and their entire premise is to get the arts out across the United States, across the world, and specifically to communities that would not necessarily ever have the arts come to them. Mm-hmm. They're not like, you know, Chicago or Los Angeles or New York City, where they have huge multi-museums and so forth, you know. And so I thought, this is really amazing. I've never heard of this organization, and the fact that they're a nonprofit, the FITA Museum is a nonprofit. It just seemed really fantastic. And we had to jump through a lot of hoops. You know, they didn't know who we were. So there was a lot of communication going back and forth. Christina and I had to do a very formal portfolio and so forth. And what's amazing is that our initial contact, who is Michelle Hargrave, who is the director of the FIGI, and she went to grad school with our director of digital and social media here at the FITA Museum. They knew each other. And Lee Wishner, who works here, she said, you really should get in contact with these people. I think this is going to be an interesting project, you know, partnership. And she was right. And Michelle left pretty soon thereafter and worked with a woman named Kirsten Pertich, who was as well fantastic. She has since also moved on from the AFA. But it was amazing because truly the project would never have come about the way it is now if it weren't for the AFA. Mm-hmm. We could do everything. We could do all the research, find objects, photography, all of that nuts and bolts. But they are the ones who then took all of that material, worked with Prestel to form the catalog, worked with all of the museums around the country who wanted the show, including the Figgy, and they're the ones who actually made it happen.
Mm-hmm. So that is in essence how we ended up with this exhibition right here in Davenport.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about how you sourced so many items on display, because there are so many of them. Where did you even start? You know, sporting fashion, sporting wear is not something that you would normally consider a collectible item.
Very true. You know, there's not a lot of museums that have collected it. It's not fancy couture ball gowns of very expensive fabrics and hand embroideries and so forth. This is a lot of material worn in the daytime that, you know, 100 years ago, no one ever thought a museum would want it. Museums, you know, collected textiles more than they collected fashion. So it was, you know, rare for these things to survive. It's also why it took so long to do this project, was to find the objects. You know, one of the things that's tricky is that when you're standing in front of an object, it's sometimes difficult to understand how very, very rare it actually is, because you're like, well, look, right there it is. But you may be looking at the only known extant example. There's no others in other institutions. Or if there are others, there's maybe five in the world that are known. So, you know, a lot of these are very, very rare objects. Also, I have to collect according to the mission statement of the FITA Museum. I can't just willy-nilly kind of acquire things, because we are a design museum. So each object that we collect has to be its best in design, whether it's very fancy or very plain. What does it represent the very best of design within its era for what it's supposed to be? And that's very important for us. So I was looking at our collection first to see what we had, which was not a lot, and then comparing it with collections around the world, looking at the databases to see what actually is out there in other museums and what isn't in museums, and then contacting every single dealer that I knew around the world, private collectors that I knew, auction houses, I mean, you name it. And it wasn't like going out to Target or Bloomingdale's and saying, okay, I need this and this and this and this. We didn't know if we were going to find everything that we needed. You know, this is something that is practically a 24-hour a day thing for many, many years, to pull all of these objects together. Because in the catalog, not just the traveling show, but in the catalog, it's actually over 750 objects.
Yeah. Well, the catalog, since you brought that up, we do need to mention that, because it's absolutely beautiful. The photographs are extraordinary. It's very detailed. It's also very large. It's coffee table sized. It's around 340 pages, and it's on sale.
344.
And it's on sale at the Figgy Gift Shop, I should
say. That's right. And, you know, it is heavy, but we say, well, that means you can just work out with it.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, you can. I didn't think about that.
Those arms, you know, those shoulders.
Well, you know, I actually weighed it this morning, believe it or not. It's just under 6 pounds. It's
wow, okay.
Yes. It's like a, you know, like one of those smaller dumbbells. But
that's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. And the foreword to the catalog was written by Serena Williams. And Serena, perhaps more than any other modern day athlete, has had to endure endless critiques of her fashion choices on the court. So she seemed to me to very personally embody the questions and the conversations that this show brings up.
Indeed. And her write-up is beautiful. I mean, it's so marvelous. You know, we stopped the catalog at 1960 because of the timeline, because by the time you get to 1960, everything that a woman wears for sportswear has been invented. The difference for us today is the textile technology that's been developed that is then applied to these already designed elements. And we wanted to bring the catalog up to the present, you know, and what better than Serena Williams? I mean, she's just a living icon and is such a mentor to so many different people around the world, you know. And so we had been thinking about, okay, you know, for the forward, who would we want? And I was driving to church one morning and Serena Williams popped into my mind. And I thought, that would be fantastic. Good luck with that. But as it turned out, that Kirsten Purchett, who is our, you know, our collaborator with the American Federation of Arts, her father is a sports attorney, and he was able to find the group of people that Serena works with. We contacted her, talked about the project. She had a lot of faith in us because, you know, it's not like I could give her a catalog to say, hey, look how great this is going to be. And she then agreed to do the forward to the catalog. And I want to tell everybody that she did this at no cost. It was not like we paid a celebrity, you know, to write the forward. This was something that she really believed in, and she loved it because, of course, it will live on into the future and hopefully continue to influence young girls and young women today to keep pressing forward with the things that they're interested in doing out in the world, whether it's passive sport or, like Serena Williams, really, really incredibly active, and to change, continue to change and push forward all of these abilities that we all should have completely freely.
Mm-hmm. Well, she very articulately says in her foreword, and these were her words actually, that it she feels the exhibition explores what it means to be truly equal, what it means to be feminine, and gender's role in fashion. So it did just seem to mesh very well. And she also mentioned that she feels the tennis court is a stage, and that is so true. You know, along with the exhibition, the Figge staff has been very busy. They've organized an extensive array of companion events for this show, ranging from the Quad City Symphony Orchestra's performance, that's scheduled March 23rd. Ballet Quad Cities is doing a performance at the Figge on April 13th. They have a series of women-directed feature-length films. There's docent-led tours, a fashion show. The list just goes on and on. And I'm happy to say that you will be returning to Davenport on Thursday, April 20th for a curator talk. And we're so looking forward to having you back.
Yes. Christina Johnson and I are both flying out to give a behind-the-scenes. We get a lot of questions, just like, you know, for NPR about how is it that we brought this together. And so we want to bring up some of those fun projects, how we found some of the objects, behind the scenes of the photo shoots that we did, the research being compiled, working with the AFA. You know, it's really the A, B, and C of how you work on a project like this. You know, and anybody can do it. You know, this is not something that should be limited to just, you know, somebody who has a title of curator. If you're interested in working on a project, you know, you just find a passion. I mean, truly, because this was a passion project for all of us. And, you know, if you've got that passion, you're going to be able to see the project through, mm-hmm. no matter what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, your passion definitely shows through. And we're so grateful for that. And I wanted to finish with a quote that's in your catalog by Claire McCardle. And back in 1956, she wrote this: "Sports clothes changed our lives, perhaps more than anything else, made us independent women." And reading that line made me pause and really think. I have often discounted fashion in a way as something that's less important, but this makes you realize how essential it was for us to even begin the process of living full and equal lives.
Yes,
it does matter, and it is important.
And it's very true. And that's one of the things I want everybody to hopefully take away when they see sporting fashion at the Figge Museum. You know, these are all actual authentic objects. These are none of them are recreations. All of these were worn by women who are now gone. And, you know, but hopefully they'll inspire the future. And that's one of the things that Christina and I were really cognizant of when we were working on the project, was to never compare a woman in the past with a woman in the future, as if the future had it better. Every single woman in this project and in the catalog was the modern woman. And she overcame the obstacles that were in front of her at her time. Just like women today, you are the modern women, and you're overcoming obstacles and you're moving forward. And your sisters in the future will be looking back on you with thanks. And that's just what all of these women did in this catalog.
Kevin Jones, thank you so much for bringing this exhibition here and for talking today. It was delightful.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Sporting Fashion, Outdoor Girls 1800 to 1960 is on display at the Figge Art Museum in Davenport through May 7th. Don't miss it. To view the full list of associated programming and museum hours, visit figgeartmuseum.org. This has been Carolyn Martin, talking art in the Quad Cities for WVIK. Our theme music is provided by a Quad City legend, the late Ellis Kell.